Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick, and today we're going to be kicking off a yearly tradition, our coverage of some of the winners of this year's Ig Nobel Prizes.
That's right. We've been doing the Ig Nobel Prizes on the show for many, many years now. We almost never cover them right away. The awards usually drop, and I think this has been the case for like at least a decade now. They tend to come out during September or rarely earlier on. I think they would come out in October. But in any event, we're often already wrapped up in Halloween stuff by that point, and we end up coming back to the Ig Nobel Prizes early November. It's kind of like a post-Halloween detox to get away from a lot of the spooky stuff and into some other topic areas. But this year is a little different. I mean, last year was a little different because, Joe, you were on parental leave. Mm-hmm. So our former producer, Seth, had to pop in and sort through these with me. So this year we're back, and we welcome you back. But also this year we're actually ahead of schedule and hitting the Ig Nobels before October.
Feels good to be prompt.
If you're not familiar with the Ig Nobels, these are a series of awards given out once a year by the scientific humor journal, the Annals of Improbable Research, edited for many years now by Mark Abrahams. This of course is a play on on the Nobel Prize, you know, the Nobel Prize in various, areas, physics, chemistry, et cetera. And there's a similar, organizational structure in place for the Ig Nobel Prizes. Their stated purpose is, quote, to honor achievements that first make people laugh and then make them think. If you want to learn more about them, go to improbable.com. You can find out more about the magazine. You can see they have a wonderful list of all the winners going back to the very beginning of the whole project.
Yes. Now, usually the prizes are given out in honor of studies that are published in regular scientific journals, but just might have to do with some intentionally or unintentionally funny subject matter. But occasionally, it also focuses on papers that are themselves like intended to be funny or satirical. One example that comes to mind is a study from several years back that was about the rheology of cats, rheology being the study of how materials flow. And so the idea is like, you know, are cats a liquid or a solid? So, you know, that is a joke. But also there was some interesting stuff to ponder in that paper. And the pattern continues. Most of this year's winners are regular scientific studies published in academic journals. But the, for example, my selection for today is more of a historical interest paper that leans on a subject that was, I think, intended to be selected because it was funny.
Yeah. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is that, yeah, at the heart of all of these, there is some genuine science or a quest for knowledge, some seriousness. It's not all just complete tomfoolery. And I think that's ultimately what they're celebrating here. That's one of the reasons we keep covering it, is that with each entry, you know, we often ask the question, well, what makes this funny? And you kind of point to the obvious, you know, it may be, say, a study that has to do with, say, you know, flatulence or something. And it's pretty obvious why that's funny. But then there is also the follow-up question, why is it important? And in all cases, there's something there. There's some way to answer that. Like, it's the study involved. You know, it may seem like, you know, it's the pure shrimp on a treadmill territory where, like, this is, you know, well, how does this possibly benefit anything? But it is benefiting our scientific understanding of ourselves or the world to some extent. And I would say the other cool thing about it is that, yeah, I mean, it inevitably draws attention to some of these smaller studies and the work of professional researchers and scientists. So it's all good.
Now, Rob, if you're ready to get into the actual winners we're going to talk about today, I think maybe a good place to start would be on the Halloweeniest of all the Ig Nobel Prize winners I can recall.
That's right. We're talking about the Mechanical Engineering Prize that goes to a paper that deals with necrobotics, which, if you're not already familiar with the term, yes, it does sound like it could be made up by some sort of a 1980s science fiction film or earlier that we're watching on Weird House Cinema. But no, this is an actual term, and we'll explain what it means here shortly.
It sounds like a Stuart Gordon movie.
Yeah. So the paper in question is Necrobotics, Biotic Materials as Ready-to-Use Actuators by Yap et al., published in Advanced Science, Volume 9, Number 29, from 2022. So the entire premise of this study is at once completely sensible and also morbidly sensational. And I think that's one of the reasons it really zings. So the authors touch on biomimicry, which, as you probably know, refers to the idea of turning to nature to help solve engineering problems. Because why spend a few years trying to solve a problem that nature already solved over the course of evolutionary time?
Now, of course, some solutions that are engineered by evolution are easier to reproduce or reverse engineer and reproduce in inanimate technology than others are. For example, we still can't really like recreate what's happening in a human brain. That is a very complex bioengineering problem that we have not fully reverse engineered yet. But there are lots of other sort of simpler biological mechanisms that we have been able to look at and say, ah, okay, yeah, here's how that works. And we could make technology that does the same thing.
But the authors here point out, yeah, you know, this is all well and good, but why don't you, you don't have to just stop at merely copying the design. We can actually reuse parts and materials. And this is where we get specifically into the idea of a biohybrid robot, something that goes a step further by incorporating living materials directly into engineered systems. So a kind of cybernetic approach, really. Now, it's my understanding that biohybrids in general covers a lot of things that are maybe less necro in flavor, such as biohybrid materials that contain both a biopolymer and a synthetic polymer. But that's just one route. As for biohybrid robots, you can think of them in general as somewhere on the same slider with the concept of a cyborg, except more of a robot that's made with some organic materials or parts.
Tired, donating your body to scientific research. Wired, donating your body to a robot's body.
Yeah, in a way, I think one of our, you know, classic cinematic examples of a cyborg can be very, can throw off our understanding of what these things can consist of. Because you think of the Terminator, right? He's essentially a robot. He's just a robot, but he has this living tissue on top of all of that as a disguise. Mm-hmm. But he can completely lose that, and he's still very functional. as we've discussed on the show before, the topic of cybernetics is a little more complicated than that and involves a lot more. But in this particular case, this idea of the biohybrid robot, it's, you know, imagine that it's not so much the robot is covered in the skin, but the robot then actually uses human skin in various places to help, you know, move better, to perform its functionality better, et cetera.
So they say in the movie Terminator that the living tissue on the outside of the T-800 is grown for the cyborgs in labs mm-hmm. they have. But imagine instead that maybe, say, when the Terminator gets injured, it can, like, harvest the flesh of its enemies in order to graft onto its own skin and become part of its living encasement.
There you go. It's the Terminator remake right there. You can thank Joe McCormick for that.
But repurposing the dead flesh of living organisms for itself.
I like it. I think it could work. But a couple of real world examples of this, at least in, you know, ideas that have been explored in various studies and projects. There was a 2018 University of Tokyo project that created a robotic finger using rat muscle cells. There was also a 2012 Harvard Caltech project that produced a silicone jellyfish. So kind of like a jellyfish robot using rat heart muscle cells. And then they later worked on a kind of like swimming ray using some of the same technology.
Now, lest people start getting weirded out at the idea of using animal body parts as technology, it might be worth pointing out that I think really the only novel part here is that it is using independently moving body parts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they stress here in a way that I found kind of comedic. I laughed a little bit at this, but also it's a totally valid point. They point out that, like, look, humans have long used bio-derived materials in their tool use. I mean, that's the basic 2001 A Space Odyssey model, right? You know, you pick up the bone and you use it. We've talked about this numerous times on the show in the past, using bits and pieces of animals, using all of the buffalo in some cases to create various bits of human ingenuity, various tools, materials, clothing, etc.
Animal hides, yeah, are mm-hmm. a huge part of human technology.
Yeah, so there's nothing particularly weird about this. I guess it just kind of runs counter to what some people might think about as the trajectory of human materials and human inventions, that as they get more futuristic, they move further and further away from this idea of something that we've made from the natural world, and it becomes just completely synthetic. You know, matching up with these various sci-fi visions where, as on that SpongeBob episode, everything is chrome, you know, everything is metallic, etc. This seems to run counter to that in some ways, because they're asking you to imagine a robot that reaches out to you not with a metal hand, or even a metal hand that is covered with like some sort of plastic substance that is like that is kind of like human skin. No, it is reaching out to touch you with a hand that is a dead tarantula.
It's funny that you mentioned the plastic hand, though, because if it were a metal hand, you could say, okay, that's never been alive. That was always just, you know, mineral content in the ground that was mined. But if it's a plastic hand, that's derived from petroleum products, which mm-hmm. are derived from, at some point, life.
That's true. And that it's interesting how we have kind of a mental disconnect on that a lot of the time. Maybe part of it is, being in denial of our fossil fuel dependency to some extent. But the other part is like, yeah, I mean, plastic is, that was made by magic. That was made by human wit and ingenuity. It has no connection to the natural world, right?
Yeah, that plastic is the refined and reprocessed remains of organisms that lived millions of years ago.
But the idea of the tarantula hand here is actually key to the study. I'm exaggerating a little bit by making it a tarantula and making it a robot reaching for you. But the whole paper here is about the idea of repurposing a dead spider as a quote-unquote ready-to-use actuator. And they highlight that it's actually fewer steps involved. Like, this is a shortcut. This is not just like this is not something where you'd be doing it and you'd be overworking for just some sort of grotesque mechanism. No, they're saying like you actually would have to do less to take advantage of this. Fewer steps in the production.
I love this.
They write, quote, "The unique walking mechanism of spiders, relying on hydraulic pressure rather than antagonistic muscle pairs to extend their legs, results in a necrobotic gripper that naturally resides in its closed state and can be opened by applying pressure. The Necrobotic Gripper is capable of grasping objects with irregular geometries and up to 130% of its own mass. Furthermore, the gripper can serve as a handheld device and innately camouflages in outdoor environments.
Okay, the last sentence.
I don't know why that part is important. Yeah.
Do we need a stealth hand that can grab things 130% of its own mass?
I don't know, but it does give us more horror movie ideas, I suppose.
Yeah, that one seems a little bit, I don't know. But I never thought about this before. But yeah, so they're talking about how the idea that like when a spider closes its legs, it's operating on a different mechanism than how, say, mammals would move their limbs. Mammals, as it says, move their limbs with antagonistic muscle pairs. So, you know, mm-hmm. muscles contracting or relaxing in order to bend the skeleton of the joints. Whereas with spiders, it has to do with an internal hydraulic pressure state to cause the legs to extend. And so when the pressure is relaxed, that is when the legs close, which I guess makes sense because when you see a dead spider, it tends to have its legs curled up.
Exactly. They point that out. Yeah, that when a spider dies, the pressure is no longer opposing the flexor muscles, and so you get that curled up appearance. Yeah, this is exactly how you find them if you start busting open dirt dauber nests and you find them squirreled away in there to feed the growing young. But they do point out, by the way, that we don't need to stop at spiders. All manner of bio-derived parts could be repurposed in an engineered system. And again, there's nothing creepy about a spider-handed necrobot at all, so we shouldn't, you know, act like it is. But I included images, and I imagine these images can be, I think the paper itself is not behind a paywall or anything, so folks can pull this up. You can find a link on the Ig Nobel Prize's website. But they show exactly the steps that are involved, and it involves, first of all, euthanizing the spider, and then a fabrication a step that requires just one thing to be done. And that's, quote, inserting a needle into the prosoma region of a deceased spider and fixing the needle to the spider's body with glue to form a hermetic seal.
This is still not creepy, folks. Stop acting like it. Yeah.
So the legs grip inward and then pressure is applied via the syringe that you just glued to the dead spider to extend the legs and open the gripper. And then there you see it. Step C, the third step in the illustration, is just using the necrobotic gripper, the syringe-powered effect here, to open and close the spider as if it were a claw.
This is truly one of my favorite Ig Nobel studies we have done.
Yeah, I mean, this one's amazing, and it opens my mind to this whole world that I had no idea was really on the menu for the future, but there it is. Why is it funny? I think it's obvious that the dead spider is now a robot hand. A dead spider has been used, well, first of all, created. They did euthanize it, but then made into this gripper device. That alone is just inherently morbidly funny.
Now, if you wanted to have a cruelty-free dead spider robot hand, presumably you could bust up mud wasp nests and find all the dead spiders inside, you know, get them out and then stab needles in them and glue those needles in place and then use the hydraulic pressure to make your little robot hands.
Yeah, I like that idea. I certainly don't want to encourage anyone to hurt and kill spiders without real need to here. I do wonder, I don't think they got into this in the article. Maybe they did and I missed it, but I wonder if there might be a risk in using an already dead spider in that the organic materials might have decomposed to some degree and you wouldn't get the same grip.
Now, then again, so I was joking anyway, but now that I think about it, the spiders in the wasp nest, are those technically going to be dead or are they paralyzed and still alive in order to preserve them longer so they can be food for the young?
I don't remember off the top of my head. I know it varies with different parasitic wasps exactly how they carry out the deed. Sometimes, you know, there's a laying of eggs on the host. Sometimes they are inserted within. It varies from species to species and, you know, depending on what their host organism happens to be. It might also depend with the dirt dauber nest when you're catching them. But, you know, if you want a pristine spider necro gripper, I think you do have to make the dead spider yourself. You have to make it dead yourself. Now, why is it important, this study? Well, you know, again, I think the idea of you know, of just necrobotics in general, you know, it's nothing to scoff at. You know, we might consider a kind of post-synthetic or beyond synthetic material science of the future. You know, while machines of the future will continue to have synthetic parts, what if biotic and even repurposed tissues play an important role in at least key parts of the design, particularly where you need some sort of a mechanical interaction to take place. And you could either, you know, you could fine tune some sort of artificial system and gears and 3D printed pieces, or you could turn to pre-existing structures and materials, be it the muscles of a rat's heart or the, the fantastic limbs of a spider. Mm.
Shake hands with spider.
Yeah, I do love this idea of the tarantula hand spider. Yeah. Makes me think of the like tarantula hand puppets that you sometimes see. And it's one of these things too, that if we saw this in a movie from the 60s, we would say, this is ridiculous. This is like Robot Monster. They clearly just had a robot costume and two of these spider hand puppets and they just made it all up. But no, they actually had glimpsed the future had they made this movie. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, you ready for the next prize?
Yeah, what do you have for us here, Joe?
Okay, so the 2023 Chemistry and Geology Prize was awarded for a 2017 article called Eating Fossils, written for the newsletter of the Paleontological Association, a UK-based group that promotes the study of paleontology and publishes multiple academic journals. And the author is Jan Zawachewicz, a geologist and stratigrapher who is an emeritus professor of paleobiology at the University of Leicester in the UK. And a note, so I said he's a geologist and a stratigrapher. Stratigraphy is the subdiscipline of geology that's focused on understanding geological strata, meaning the layers of rock in Earth's crust. How they form, how they're ordered and structured, and so forth. It's also worth flagging, as I mentioned earlier, that usually the winners of the Ig Nobel Prizes are studies published in scientific journals. This is not one of those. This is instead a sort of historical interest feature about, as the title says, eating fossils. And congrats to Zawachewicz, because I loved this article. So I'm going to start just by reading the opening passage. The rock lying by the roadside did not look like much of interest at first, a rather nondescript limestone with little more to show to casual observation than a few vague blotches. Anyway, old habits die hard, so I picked it up, licked the surface, and put it and my hand lens to my eye. Now, okay, so half of that picture makes sense to a non-expert. As a non-geologist, I might expect a geologist to pick up a rock and use a magnifying lens to look at it. But licking the rock, is that part of the standard geology modus operandi?
Yeah, I'd never heard of this before.
It seems to some extent, yes. Zawachewicz says, licking the rock, of course, is part of the geologist and paleontologist's armory of tried and much-tested techniques used to help survive in the field. Wetting the surface allows fossil and mineral textures to stand out sharply rather than being lost in the blur of intersecting micro-reflections and micro-refractions that come out of a dry surface. And I thought about that for a second. I said, oh, that is really interesting. I think many of us will have noticed that a wet rock looks very different than a dry rock. A wet rock has, you can see some of the textures and the grain more sharply. Some of the structure of the mineral is revealed. And of course, if you, you know, don't have like a, I don't know, like a bucket of water with you, mm-hmm. you, of course, have some water in your mouth. You can lick the rock or spit on it, put some saliva on it, and see that grain and structure with more clarity.
Yeah, and I guess it allows you to put a very controlled amount of moisture on the rock as well, whereas yeah, if you're pouring a little water from your canteen, you're going to waste more of your water and so forth.
And Zawachewicz says that it just so happened on this day with this rock, his big old slobbery tongue helped reveal something amazing. The rock he found contained the most remarkably preserved nummulites, which are fossil remnants of a variety of foraminiferin. And I'll have more to say about these organisms in a bit. But in this particular fossil, these ancient organisms, their shells were preserved with three-dimensional structure intact, all bound together in a chunk of calcite. So having established that the main purpose of licking the rock is to be able to see it better, you still might be wondering, what does a collection of fossilized foraminifera taste like? Zawachewicz writes, quote, "The taste now was likely merely registered as generically slightly dusty and then instantly forgotten. I had always thought it entirely superfluous to identification, but perhaps not so. As we contemporary types develop capabilities in one direction, we might be entirely losing them in another. Go right back to the beginnings of our science, and our ancestors and their senses were attuned to different settings. One could then, it seems, literally develop a taste for stratigraphy."
Oh, wow.
So Zawachewicz goes on to talk about an important figure in the history of his field, a man he calls this ancestral stratigrapher, the Italian geologist Giovanni Arduino, who lived 1714 to 1795. who notably came up with the idea of a geological division of Earth's history into different periods that would correlate with strata in the crust. These periods he called the primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary. And these categories have been majorly revised and refined by modern geologists, but the basic principle still sticks, that you can identify sedimentary rock layers and correlate them with different historical periods in which they were laid down. So Sawachevich describes Arduino as, quote, a busy man who had to be everywhere at once. This guy apparently worked as a mining engineer and as a surveyor, but was also just an all-purpose freak for rocks and fossils. He ravenously collected and studied them from all over the northeast of Italy, from the Alps down to the Po River Delta around Venice, and he called himself a mineralogist, meaning he was into all different types. He was into rocks, fossils, sediments, springs, and all that stuff, everything about the Earth. Now, the interesting thing is that despite his importance in this, in the history of this branch of geology, Arduino was in some sense an amateur, and he did not publish his theories in books. Instead, they appeared in letters that he sent to a friend of his who was a professor at the University of Padua, who in turn published Arduino's letters in a Venetian journal, which then filtered out to other scholars who took the ideas and refined them further, and they ended up morphing into the ideas we have today in stratigraphy. But here's where we get back to the flavor of rocks and fossils. Sawachevich describes these letters that Arduino wrote to his friend, the professor, which were only translated into English and published in full the year before this article. So I guess that would have been 2016. And Sawachevich says that these are fun reading, full of enthusiastic conversational style, and also just full of gushing about crushing. And all of Arduino's crushes are rocks and minerals and mineral springs.
Awesome.
So I want to read a passage here where Sawachevich is setting up and quoting sections of these letters. So this is Sawachevich writing it first. Quote, fossil shells in a mud rock, for instance, and coal fragments, when burned, leave an ash that, quote, as soon as it is placed on the tongue, it burns like fire and leaves a flavor equally bitter and urinous. When spat out, it leaves a certain sweetness and a skinned tongue. Springs that emerge from a stratum full of marcasite and coal, quote, have an acid, spicy flavor. Vitriolic, yes, but with a certain pleasantness that I cannot describe, like the acidity of wine. These waters, quote, made me far less nauseous than did the waters from the same source that I have tasted here in Vicenza and at the Schio. The white and micaceous sediment from one stratum has no taste in the raw state, he said, but once burnt, quote, acquired a flavor as well as a caustic quality from the calcining of the spar. This man loved rocks. He loved to collect them. He wanted to understand them, and he wanted to know which ones tasted like pea and which ones were spicy and which ones tasted like a fine Montepulciano.
Wow.
And Sawachevich says that Arduino also described in exquisite detail the appearance and smell of mineral specimens as they were burned, dissolved, boiled, and so forth. And he says that Arduino was doing something that partially kind of feels like alchemy and partially just kind of feels like rapturous, sensual pleasure at the experience of rocks, but then in part is also very detailed scientific analysis. You know, he's making an interesting point that without the modern equipment that we use for chemical analysis of minerals, information about taste and smell was actually very useful data to log, which would maybe help us better understand what these minerals were. In a way, the tongue could be seen as like the chemistry lab of the body. I think you could argue that it exists primarily to do fast chemical analysis on anything that is about to enter the digestive tract. And this would be both for screening purposes, so to reject chemicals that could hurt us, but also for conditioning purposes, to cause immediate pleasure when we're eating something nutritionally desirable, to sort of condition our brains to repeat the behavior that got that substance into the mouth.
This is all a great point, because I think it's very easy for human beings to think of, like, you know, we're very visual. It's easy to sort of cut out all the other senses and only focus on the visual and then the intellectual, and of course, you know, and intellectual information that's been recorded and so forth, and forget that, yeah, we do have sensory awareness in these other realms as well. And those senses can be used to understand and catalog the world. It reminds me a bit of, I think we talked about this in the past when we were talking about mushroom foraging, that mm-hmm. experienced foragers, and I want to underline that, experienced foragers will sometimes taste, but not consume, taste and then spit out portions of fungi that they're in the process of identifying. And they'll utilize that additional sense data into their identification process. Again, experts. Not eating the mushrooms. Don't attempt this if you are not an expert. Don't eat any mushrooms because you listen to this podcast, etc. All the standard disclaimers, but examples of, you know, this sort of older way of using all the senses to try and understand bits of the natural world.
Yeah, I think that's a great point and a great point of comparison. Likewise, I would say the same thing for minerals. Don't just go tasting rocks and sediment and minerals. You don't know what you're putting in your mouth, and it mm-hmm. could very well be dangerous. But given those caveats about safety, especially if you don't have to do this, to the 18th century mineralogist, trying to understand the mineral world with a comparatively limited toolkit, tasting sediment and rocks and fossils and spring water makes a lot of sense. Those flavors are potentially useful information.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the first subsection of Zavacevich's essay here about eating fossils. But there are more. He next goes on to talk about the story of the 1951 Explorers Club dinner at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York, which famously, or maybe better to say infamously, served attendees a meat dish that the host of the event originally claimed was the meat of Megatherium, an extinct genus of giant ground sloth. Though later reports in the media, I think specifically in the Christian Science Monitor, claimed that the meat had actually been from a woolly mammoth. In both cases, these animals, the animals in question, were long extinct. So the story went that the meat served at this dinner had been excavated frozen from a site in at the Aleutian Islands and held in stock by a man named Father Bernard Hubbard, popularly known in the media as the Glacier Priest. And this sounds more and more like a D&D scenario.
It does, yes. The Glacier Priest now requests that you consume the precious fossil meat. Go ahead and give us a constitution check on all that.
Yeah. Better have only the fighter eat it first, yeah.
Well, even the woolly mammoth meat, though, this is, of course, you know, we do know that organic material from woolly mammoths have been preserved in snowy and frozen environments. Is this real? Did they really eat frozen woolly mammoth?
Well, that's what the report said originally. But in 2014, this story was finally proven to be a hoax because apparently one member of the Explorers Club who had been unable to attend the dinner in 1951 somehow got his portion of the dish to go. I guess they gave him a to-go container. I don't know how he got it, but he never ate it. And somehow his portion of this meat dish ended up at the Yale Peabody Museum of Natural History, preserved somehow. I don't know if they packed it in formaldehyde or whatever, but they somehow preserved it and had it there at the museum.
It wasn't just in the fridge the whole time.
I hope not. Yeah. Gary's leftovers. Yeah. In 2014, Testing of the sample revealed, despite the fact that the meat had been cooked more than 60 years before, that it was not mammoth and it was not sloth, but it was actually, do you want to take a guess?
Ooh, I mean, you're tempted to guess something close to a woolly mammoth, like an elephant, right?
It was actually turtle meat.
Hmm.
So I went and looked up, Zawachevich doesn't include it, but I had to know more. So I went and looked up the paper in question here. This was a paper published in PLOS One in 2016 by Jessica R. Glass, Matt Davis, Timothy Walsh, Eric Sargis, and Adelgisa Chacon. Title of the paper, Was Frozen Mammoth or Giant Ground Sloth Served for Dinner at the Explorers Club? This was the year 2016. Just to note that it is apparently more difficult to do DNA testing on older remains and also more difficult to do DNA testing on meat that has been cooked. But they did succeed at testing it. This is from their abstract, quote, "We sequenced a fragment of the mitochondrial cytochrome B gene and studied archival material to verify its identity, which, if genuine, would extend the range of megatherium over 600%. Because if it actually came from the Aleutian Islands or from, the Glacier Priest. No idea that giant ground sloths were living there at any point. But anyway, they say, if it actually was genuine, it would extend the range of megatherium over 600%, quote, and alter our views on ground sloth evolution. Our results indicate that the meat was not mammoth or megatherium, but green sea turtle, Chelonia mitis. Hmm. The prehistoric dinner was likely an elaborate publicity stunt. Now, specifically the green sea turtle, this is sad. I should add that this animal is considered endangered today. I don't know what its status was in 1951, but I'm so confused because if you're doing a hoax, why would you try to pass off sea turtle as extinct giant ground sloth meat? Why not just use like beef or goat or something?
I guess you could argue that you would want to serve something that is edible, of course, but also tastes different. Like that people are going to try it and they're not going to say, oh, well, this tastes just like beef or this tastes just like chicken. They're going to be like, what? This is a little different. This is strange. And it makes sense that it's strange because I'm eating a creature that has been extinct for so long. That being said, it seems like, are there not multiple culinary methods you could use to sort of weirden up your meat and make it taste strange, like different marinades and so forth?
Probably. I mean, people could be like, huh, this tastes a lot like goat, but that wouldn't prove that it was goat. You could still continue maybe it's just that, oh yeah, mammoth meat tastes like goat.
Hmm. This makes me think of the whole situation of mock turtle and like trying to then replicate turtle meat by turning to other animals. Like, why is the turtle wrapped up in this weird cycle of imitation meats?
Yeah. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Okay, so there's another example of people claiming that they were eating the meat of a 250,000-year-old organism, but in fact, it was just a sea turtle for some reason. But finally, in this essay, Zawichevich comes back around to the subject of nummulites, mentioned earlier because those were the remarkably preserved three-dimensional fossils in that rock that he told the story about finding on the side of the road and licking to see better. Nummulites are fascinating in their own right. So nummulites are a genus of foraminifera dating back millions of years, notable for their disc-shaped or lens-shaped shells, which are found abundantly in fossil form. The organisms themselves are single-celled protozoa, and they form this protective shell on the outside called a test. These tests or shells have been observed since ancient times. In fact, what's called nummulitic limestone, which is that's sedimentary calcium carbonate rock from archaic seafloors containing huge proportions of nummulite fossils. Nummulitic limestone was what was quarried out by the ancient Egyptians and used to build the pyramids of Giza. So the pyramids are made, at least in part, out of fossil rock containing the shells of all these organisms. And these disc-shaped fossils in the pyramid blocks were noticed by the ancients. People didn't necessarily understand that they were fossilized shells of, you know, trillions of single-celled marine organisms. I've read elsewhere that in the 5th century BCE, the Greek historian Herodotus thought that these discs were lintels that had turned to stone. So maybe like, the people who built the pyramids so long ago, they spilled some lintels all over the place while they were building them, and now these lintels turned into rocks. But in fact, they are these protozoan shells, and these shells can grow to enormous sizes in some cases for some species, especially for a single-celled organism. Zawichevich mentions that I guess this would be the species, I don't know how to say this quite, I think Nummulitis millikaput, which means the thousand-head nummulite. This can grow a shell 16 centimeters in diameter. That's for a single-celled organism.
Wow.
And these really, these tough outer shells and the size of these organisms raise questions about, like, what in the ocean could actually successfully eat them? And this leads down another road where Zawichevich ends up talking about a deliciously weird obsolete thesis from a 19th to 20th century British zoologist named Randolph Kirkpatrick, who worked at the British Natural History Museum from 1886 to 1927. And in 1912, Kirkpatrick published a book that was called The Nummulosphere, an account of the organic origin of so-called igneous rocks and abyssal red clays. And this book, while now regarded as totally wrong and based entirely on observational error and classification error in looking at, the grain of rocks, seems nevertheless to hold an almost kind of cherished place in the hearts of many geologists and paleontologists. In this essay, he cites Stephen Jay Gould as one of these people who, like everybody knows this thesis is totally wrong, but there's something about it that they seem to find pleasant and amusing and almost sweet or cute. So what did Kirkpatrick argue? Well, I'm going to read here from Zawichevich's summary. Quote, "The ocean," Kirkpatrick said, "is full of organisms which efficiently extract calcium carbonate and silica from the seawater to create myriad skeletons, which then go on to become geological strata. Look at thin sections of those ancient strata through a microscope, and you will see traces of those skeletons. Many of them," he went on to say, "show the traces of the curved shells and chambers of nummulites. These were not always obvious, but could be detected with the trained eye. That trained eye then put other rocks under the microscope. With just a little more training, the same shapes could be detected in all of the specimens that Kirkpatrick looked at, including in lavas, granites, and even meteorites. The inference was clear." So what was that inference? It is that all the rocks on the surface of the earth are nummulites. The earth itself, Kirkpatrick thought, was essentially encased in a foraminiferan test of its own. There was a shell for the planet made out of rocks that were made out of the fossilized, indigestible shells of marine organisms from millions of years past. So like whatever other kind of rock you might think it is, Kirkpatrick was like, no, that's actually just a version of nummulite shells that, you know, looks different for some reason.
Nummulites all the way down.
The one, I didn't get to the bottom of this, but I was wondering, wait, why did he think that about meteorites, though? Did he also think there were nummulites in space? Or maybe he thought they didn't really come from space.
Surely that also is unbelievable, but maybe less unbelievable than like not only this world, but all worlds. It's nummulites throughout the cosmos. The idea that like, oh yeah, meteorites, that's not real. What you're looking at is nummulites.
But I guess that connects to the eating fossils idea, because it's like, oh, you got these organisms, you know, can't eat them, can't digest those shells. Where do they go? They end up on the bottom of the ocean. And in fact, they really do become a lot of, you know, a big part of these sedimentary fossil rocks, these limestones. But it is not the case that all the rocks on Earth are actually from nummulites.
Wow.
So, in my opinion, big props to Jan Zawichevich for this essay, which I would say it's a bullseye on the motto of the Ig Nobel Prizes. Yes, this essay has a lot of historical tidbits that are quite funny and silly, but it also made me think in numerous ways. Very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we often really enjoy an incorrect hypothesis about the natural world. I instantly think to the idea of the aquatic ape hypothesis that we covered on the show a while back. You know, obviously not true, but it is intriguing to sort of dive into it and think about how, you know, people became devoted to this idea. And yeah, and then on top of this whole idea of just geologists tasting rocks, how that factors into their analysis of the geology.
What is the taste of the Eocene epoch?
Ask your local geologist.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to call it there, but we will be back next time to talk about more of this year's Ig Nobel winners. And don't worry, we are going to be talking about the nose hairs of a dead man.
Oh, yeah, nose hairs. Well, that may be where we start next time. We're going to start with the nose hairs, which makes sense. They're right up front, as you have probably noticed in the mirror. Hope you'll join us for that episode. I'm going to be here, I guess, Tuesday. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, we'll just remind you that we're primarily a science podcast. We get into, you know, a little history, a little philosophy, a little what have you. But those core episodes are going to come out on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays, we do a listener mail. That's your chance to write in and chat with us about past, current, and future episodes. On Wednesdays, we do a short form artifact or monster fact episode, unless it's being preempted by something. And then on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird movie on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.